watching me.
Hello and welcome to Words and Pictures, the comics and animation show. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And my guest today is cartoonist and globetrotting journalist Ted Rall, whose new book is a graphic biography of NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden. Ted, welcome back to Words and Pictures.
Thanks for having me, SW. In the interest of the topic here, I should ask you what the S and the W stand for, since you're not entitled to the privacy of your initials.
Sticky Wicket.
Okay. Is that true?
It's true for the purposes of the show, yeah.
Okay, excellent.
Every time you're in town, you come into the studio, which I'm delighted by, sometimes accompanied by Matt Boris. I think the first time that you came through, you were still president of the American Association of Editorial Cartoonists.
That's right. So that means it was sometime probably in 2009.
That seems like an organization that's not in its heyday like it used to be.
Yeah, like the American Association of Whalebone Corset Makers, the American Association of Buggy Whip Manufacturers. Yeah, we've seen better days. But unlike those things, there's still actually a demand for what we do. What we are dealing with is a serious economic problem of just the model of how to get it to the people and get paid. I mean, there have never been as many political cartoonists being read by as many people in the United States. The problem is that the profession has been deprofessionalized so that it's hard for those cartoonists to get paid. They're all online, but we used to be in newspapers and magazines that paid us. So what you're losing is the person who lives and breathes politics morning, noon, and night, and then has the training in the background and the bandwidth to just think about drawing political cartoons. That's what's going.
Well, it seems like so many other professions where employees have been turned into contractors, and that's happened to journalists and writers.
Yeah, each year you're going to earn less than the year before. Yeah, it's definitely a downward progression. And it's weird because more people see you than ever before. So you're more famous than you ever were before, but you're getting paid less and less. I used to appear a lot in red states. Like, I had a lot of papers all throughout the South, throughout the 90s. And then, after 9/11, it was just, all canceled. Most cartoons have been canceled by most alt-weeklies, so mine's no exception.
Well, I read this essay that you wrote right after the massacre at the Charlie Hebdo magazine headquarters in Paris, where you said that there were more employed cartoonists at Charlie Hebdo magazine than at all the daily papers in America these days.
I think I said the four or five most populous states. Like, right. There's certainly, I think they killed 10 cartoonists there. And there are not 10 cartoonists working in the states of California, Texas, New York, Florida, maybe another big one like Illinois. It's pretty crazy. Here in the U.S., there's probably about 18 full-time cartoonists, which compares very unfavorably, by the way, with Iran and Zambia, countries like that.
Well, in Iran, they do jail cartoonists, but here they just sort of starve them, I guess.
Yeah, I think in Iran, actually, even when they jail them, they still get paid. So, I think that might I might go for that gig, depending on what the cell looks like.
Well, you, like me, are a dual national.
Yes.
You hold an American passport and a French passport. So it makes me wonder why...
Wait, what's yours? What's the other one?
I'm UK.
Okay.
So we're both the EU,
yeah.
Which is cool. So it does make me wonder why you just don't run off to a country that appreciates cartoonists, where you could draw comics bande dessinée in France and get a lot more appreciation for your work.
It has crossed my mind.
Do you just like the hate, that you get here in the U.S.?
I'm American, this is home. It's hard to imagine. I love France, and I can really see retiring there, and that might come up sooner rather than later, the way things
down
are going.
Down in Sauve, it seems to be so many people down there these days, American cartoonists down in the south of France.
That's true. Crumb and a lot of others. But I think that it would be hard. It's not the hate that I love. It's just that, you know, this is my entire infrastructure. My people are here, my friends, my family. You know, I really admire immigrants. I mean, you know, it's so hard to just pack up and leave everything. Even if you don't have any property, even if you're poor in your country of origin, the ability to just give up all those ties of your family, and it's just devastating. I don't think you get over it for generations. And I don't know if I have what it takes to do that. I mean, you know, the politics are a little bit better in France, and certainly, you know, you're treated better as a cartoonist. I'm off to Italy next week for a cartooning junket in Ravenna at a festival. And, you know, they pay you really well. They feed you really well. You fly into Bologna, you know, which is where Fettuccine Bolognese is from, and they pay you, and it's awesome. But I also have to say that I don't think that French or European or actually very many international cartoons are actually very good. Steve Bell at The Guardian is amazing.
Oh, yes.
There's some exceptions, especially in the UK and Australia and in Canada. But, I mean, I hate to say it. This is an English-speaking world's gig. I mean, you know, it's like jazz. Americans made it best. And Americans do it better than anyone. And I know because I'm always looking for foreign stuff because I'm an editor too. And I want to get like cool, you know, oh, here's this awesome guy from Ghana. But honestly, it's just not as sophisticated as what we do here.
Is there the bite that there used to be in editorial cartooning these days, in the days of Herblock and Conrad and John Fischetti, for example? Uh-huh.
Well, I mean, certainly, you know, the vibrancy of the profession as an economic model is nothing compared to what it used to be. So the cultural and political influence that we have has shrunk enormously. But that said, I mean, you know, if you're just looking at good cartoons, good editorial cartoons, you know, the work that people like Matt Bors and Tom Tomorrow and Ruben Bowling and Jen Sorensen are doing, I would put up against anyone, including the guys that you mentioned. I think they're better. I think they do better work, smarter work, work that I'd rather read, and it's more hard hitting. I mean, we do stand on the shoulders of giants here, but still, nevertheless, I don't think that
they're sort of more cartoony. They're sort of more that alt weekly look, as opposed to say, you know, like the Thomas Nast or Oliphant, very illustrative style.
Yeah, to me, that's better work. I mean, you know, one of the things that, as a scholar of cartoons that I would point to myself in the firmament of editorial cartooning as having done, is really try to synthesize comic strip formats into the mainstream editorial cartoon. And I think, you know, others have worked on it, but probably no one got quite as far as I did. Like, if, you know, I think if I'm remembered, that's probably what scholars will say about my stuff. So for me, I'm part of a generation of people like Dan Perkins and Ken Fisher who grew up reading comic strips and Mad Magazine. And so for us, that was the big influence. And so it's in our work, much more so than illustrations or like someone like Steve Brodner, who's pulling from illustrative styles, and Daumier, and what's his name, who did stuff for Hunter S. Thompson, Ralph Steadman.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's lots of great work in different styles, and it's, I hate to say this is good and that's bad or whatever, and there's always a tendency to like the kind of stuff that you do more than you like the kind of stuff other people do. That's why you're doing it. So look, Vintage Oliphant and Bill Malden are amazing, but I guess I prefer Vintage Charles Schulz, and that brings me to a Jen Sorensen or Matt Bors type place faster than it brings me to, say, Tom Toll's place.
Yeah, I remember telling Matt, everybody in your cartoons, even the villains, are so adorable.
Yeah. That's true. That's really true about Jen Sorensen. Yeah, everything's round. You know, I mean, I read an interview with Mort Walker, who is known for Beetle Bailey and High and Lois, that his career really took off and the money really started pouring in when he realized, go round, draw everything round. And I'm like, Jesus Christ, that's why I'm screwed. I mean, everything's jagged and angular and sharp. And no wonder no one likes it. That's like not like High and Lois and Beetle Bailey, which are in hundreds of papers. So, yeah, I think, you know, round and soft, like Jen and, you know, to some extent, Matt Bors, it's visually easier on the eyes, which is kind of cool because it draws people in who might otherwise be turned off by a punkier look.
So you mentioned the subject of abandoning your own country to go and live in a new place, which is kind of a perfect segue to talk about your book, Snowden. It's a sort of cartoon biography of Edward Snowden, the NSA whistleblower. And yeah, this has an interesting story. You decided that you wanted to go off to Moscow and talk to Edward Snowden in person, and your publisher, Seven Stories Press, was all ready to foot the bill.
Yeah, they were. And, you know, like, that's necessary. You're writing a biography of someone who's alive. Obviously, you can interview them, and you should, extensively, if you can. I've always had an interest in doing biographies. Back when Johnny Walker Lind, the American Taliban, was sentenced to prison, I repeatedly harassed his attorney for visiting rights. I wanted to go and interview the guy and do this kind of book. So that was a long time ago. That was 14 years ago, and I wanted to do. So I've always had like an interest in this form, and I read a lot of bios. Seven Stories said that they would send me to go, but unfortunately, Edward wasn't interested in talking to me. I still don't know why. I don't really mind the rejection, and I kind of don't mind rejections in general as much if I know why. If someone says, "Oh, you know, I just think your cartoons suck," then I'm like, okay, all right, that's reasonable. But if there's no reason, then it's just, I don't know why. Maybe other people don't care. I really care. I want to know, like, you know, like in college, if a girl didn't want to go out with me, I wanted to know why she didn't want to go out with me. It's like, what, is it my face? Is it the way I dress?
Even if the answer was blunt?
Yeah, even if it was like, I think you're ugly, it's like, or stupid, or you're an asshole, I'd be like, okay, well, that's cool. You know, I mean, at least then I know and I could work on it. But I feel like criticism's really important. Helps you grow, even if it's cruel. I mean, I'm in the criticism business. I'd like to think that politicians can read my cartoons and maybe, you know, come away and think, you know, maybe I shouldn't be using drones. It's so there's of course, obviously that's a pipe dream. But anyway, so the point is Snowden refused. And so I was kind of unhappy while I was working on the book. I just pulled together everything I could find from magazine articles and newspapers, pieces, and so on, and compiled it. There are no actual bios. There's two books. There's Glenn Greenwald's No Place to Hide, which is really not about Snowden. It's really about the NSA leaks. I mean, I'm simplifying, but mostly. And there's a Luke Harding book called The Snowden Files, which has a little biographical stuff, and I lifted some stuff from there. It's all cited in the footnotes. But there's a lot of inaccuracies in that book because it came out so quickly, and it's not really his fault. But this book is like the only book that's just a bio. And I don't know. It's funny that he hasn't done his own. But in any event, I sent the script and the completed proof to Snowden via his ACLU attorney, Ben Wisner. And fortunately, we did at that point get back a bunch of edits that fixed some of the mistakes that are like in the Luke Harding book and other places. So I feel good about it. I feel like, okay, well, this book is, if nothing else, it's accurate. It summarizes not only the programs and what they do in a simple, accurate way, but also his life story and the dilemma that he faced.
And there were some pretty substantial mistakes that had been repeated throughout the coverage of him, like how he exited Hong Kong for Russia, for example.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people kind of got the idea that Snowden might be a Russian spy or plant or operative because of the fact that he went to Russia. And also, there was reporting that stated that China had turned a blind eye to his departure from Hong Kong, which is administered by China, and that this was something that the U.S. government had a right to be angry about. But that's not true at all. What happened was that the Chinese really viewed Edward Snowden as a hot potato and were eager to have him leave. And they let his representatives know in no uncertain terms that the sooner he left, the happier they would be. So they were worried, actually, that he might be arrested by the Chinese and then deported to the United States, even though there is no extradition treaty, to my knowledge, between China and the U.S. So what happened is that the heat was on Snowden and his people. So he left. And when he went to the airport in Hong Kong, his passport was valid. He had valid plane tickets, passport, and an invitation visa with the Republic of Ecuador. So the plan was to fly from Hong Kong to Moscow to Havana to Ecuador. You can't get a direct flight from Hong Kong to Ecuador. So while he was in the air, then Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton turned off electronically his passport. There's a little bug in your passport, which you may have noticed, and a little logo on the front if you have a new passport. I think they all have that now. And so they just flipped a switch and effectively rendered him stateless, so that when he arrived at Moscow Sheremetyevo 2 airport to change planes, he was informed, you have problem with passport. You cannot go on next plane on Aeroflot to Havana. So he wasn't able to go.
You think you've had problems changing planes.
Yeah, no doubt. So he was stuck there like in that Tom Hanks movie, Terminal, you know, just for over a month, like washing his underwear in the sink in like the waiting area. So word to the wise, always pack extra underwear and socks. If you have extra underwear and socks, you can survive anything.
So he's been, ever since then, he's been renewing his residency visa every couple of years. And
he essentially has Russian political asylum. Uh-huh. And so that's every 2 years, and he's renewed it once. So he's good for another 2 years.
And his girlfriend, I mean, this is some trust and dedication. She just came over and joined him. And
yeah, I mean, you know, you got to imagine this from her point of view. I mean, as far as we know, and there's no reason to not believe this, he never told her before he left about any of this. You know, he knew that she would have been questioned by the FBI and debriefed, and he wanted to make sure that she couldn't spill the, you know, that she had nothing to, she wasn't inculpated in his crime. So he just split. One morning, he just left like he was going to work. And instead, you know, it's like, I'm going out for cigarettes. And then he, you know, he went to the airport in Honolulu where they lived and vanished. So you can imagine the feelings that she went through. I mean, she's living with this guy. She's in love with him. They've been together for years. It's a serious relationship. And, you know, suddenly she comes home and he's packed up and gone. She knows not where. And then, like, a few weeks later, there's an international manhunt, and he's the world's most wanted man, her boyfriend. And he's being called a traitor and a cyber criminal and a hacker by the president of the United States. It must have made her head spin. But obviously, she's a smart person, and she wrapped her head around it eventually. And so they're back together.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Kontzer, and I'm joined in the studio today by Ted Rall, the author of the graphic biography, Snowden. And those who've seen the Laura Poitras documentary film, Citizen 4, have seen how Edward Snowden hooked up with Glenn Greenwald, the Guardian journalist, and Laura Poitras, and filmed these days of going through the NSA files in this hotel room in Hong Kong. And it's interesting that when he finally went on TV, they threw up a fake backdrop of Hong Kong, which is how people figured out where he was.
Yeah, that is funny. I thought they also figured it out from the stuff in the hotel room, like the lamp. Like, people who knew that hotel were said, oh, I stayed in that hotel. Yeah. And so, you know how hotels have certain distinctive furnishings. That's why you should always just stay in, like, a Marriott, because they all look the same.
So, in the book that you have out from Seven Stories Press, Snowden, one of the points you make about Snowden is that geography was, in some sense, destiny. Edward Snowden grew up in the suburb of Washington, D.C., that it was sort of a company town for the NSA.
That's right. We're talking about Crofton, Maryland. He's not born there. He's born in South Carolina. But he grew up as a little kid in Crofton all throughout his youth. It's only 5 miles away from NSA headquarters in Fort Meade, Maryland, which if you've driven around there, you will see from two major highways the big NSA exit. It's pretty obvious. And if you live in Crofton, most people in your neighborhood have at least one parent who works at the NSA or works for another intelligence agency, perhaps the CIA or the DIA or the MAPS office. There's a lot of intelligence agencies that people don't even know about because they don't get much press, but they're also they handle highly classified information. And there's also a lot of security contractors. Snowden, it must be remembered, didn't spend much of his career working for the federal government ever. He spent most of it working for private contractors or subsidiaries of the NSA or CIA. He bounced around a lot. I guess he was an ambitious guy. And then at a certain point, he kind of, once he realized that he wanted to collect these documents and become a whistleblower, he changed jobs a lot so that he would have different kinds of access, allowing him to obtain different kinds of information that he would be able to collect and eventually reveal. So he was very methodical and planned. But his last job was at a private NSA contracting firm called Booz Allen Hamilton in Honolulu.
And one of the points you make is there's not a whole lot of idealists working for these contractors that deal with the NSA. And he was one of them, or he became one of them.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, there's one of the statistics when I was doing the research for the book that boggled my mind was the idea that 1.4 million Americans had access to many or all of the same highly classified files that Snowden had access to. And that blew me away for two reasons. First of all, it really underscores the size of America's security state infrastructure. I mean, you know, we don't have 1.4 million editorial cartoonists or radio hosts or journalists. And, you know, I mean, I would argue that a country that had 1.4 million journalists would probably be more of a democracy than what we have. You know, we don't have 1.4 million soccer coaches or priests. You know, why do we have so many people working in this profession? This is more people than Walmart employ, and it's the nation's largest employer. So literally, the security state is a major economic factor. If these people all went out of business, if these NSA were closed, CIA and so on, and all these people were thrown out onto the streets, you'd have another housing crash, the likes of which we saw in 2008. It would be a major economic reckoning, because this is trillions of dollars that go into Americans spying on one another. It's not really dissimilar from East Germany under the Stasi, when husbands and wives would sometimes discover that they had both been paid separately to spy on one another at the end of the Cold War when the wall came down. So that blew me away. And then the other thing that number, that one in a million thing, brought home was, you know, Edward Snowden. Why him? I mean, you know, how is it that 1,399,998, I'm going to say 98, because there's also Thomas Drake, who was a whistleblower in the 2000s, and I talked to him in the book. What is it, like, literally these one or two guys out of 1.4 million, what's unique about them? You know, I mean, are they right and everyone else is crazy? Or is everyone else right and they're crazy? Or is there something else going on? And what is it about them that made them feel that this was the right thing to do and the right way to act? So those are the questions that I was interested in exploring. And I engage in a little bit of armchair psychoanalysis, trying to get to the bottom of, you know, hey, you know, this is a very idealistic young man, a libertarian. Certainly libertarianism feeds into this. Libertarians are very interested in privacy rights. But, you know, what? None of the other 1.4 million were libertarians? Of course they were. Many. And then what about the concern over the constitutional violations, which are unquestioned? Defenders of these NSA programs argue that they're necessary to protect us from terrorism. And that's a perfectly valid argument to make. But it's not valid to make the argument that they're legal, and nobody really does. They're not legal programs. They're not authorized by Congress. They haven't been authorized by the Patriot Act. They kind of have a jerry-rigged quality of baling wire and twine holding them together legally, and a bunch of public opinions issued, for example, by the so-called FISA court, which isn't a real court and authorized by the Federal Intelligence Surveillance Act. And it's kind of amazing to me that other people didn't have these legal problems, you know, the Fourth Amendment violations on a broad scale. You're talking about the mass interception and collection of every digital and analog communication possible in the United States and in throughout most of the world. So we are talking about, if you're listening to me, every one of your emails, all of your text messages, all of your voice over internet calls, all of your bank statements, your credit card statements, you name it, even your mail. Your mail is being scanned and tracked through the Postal Service. So it's amazing to me that nobody else thought that was a problem. You know, he was a Boy Scout, but hey, I was a Boy Scout. I mean, you know, it's like there's millions of Boy Scouts. You know, his parents were divorced. divorced. Yeah, my parents were divorced. I mean, there's a lot of things about him that just are very ordinary. In fact, he's really not remembered by his classmates or the people he was in scouts with. He was boring. He was not an interesting person.
You talked with some of the people he grew up with, and he was a cipher. I think this is one reason why people are so fascinated with him, is because there's so little information about him, and he's not very forthcoming himself, as you found out. And so, yeah, he seemed like the perfect person, a very tech-savvy kid, liked video games, was an introvert, and the perfect person to go into this industry.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Although it's funny because he had such an incredibly unorthodox background educationally. He only had a GED, not because he was stupid and did drugs and dropped out, but he dropped out because he got mono in junior year in high school. And when he came back, the workload that he would have had to make up seemed so overwhelming that he just didn't know how to deal. And so he just like said, screw it, I'll just get the GED and go to community college. And he went to community college, but he wasn't into it, and he preferred to just play video games, Tekken, and read manga. And he started a website of his own about manga. So he was a geek. He was a, you know, kind of an unusual character for someone that you'd expect to become a systems analyst working at the highest levels of national intelligence, which is what he was by the time he was 25. I mean, 21 years old, he's got nothing going on in his life at all. He'd washed out of the military. He'd tried to join the U.S. Army. He joined special forces. He thought he was going to liberate the people of Iraq from the oppression of Saddam Hussein. He believed in all that. He was a right winger. He was a nationalist, a patriot. But he washed out. He broke both of his feet in a basic training and an accident. Again, speaking of not being forthcoming, as you mentioned, he won't say what exactly happened. He said only he says cryptically that his feet are weird. Mm. And so if I ever meet him, Edward, if you're hearing this, I'm going to look at your feet. So who breaks both of their feet in a training accident? I mean, at the same time. Anyway, so he went from in 4 years from being just, you know, a loser to being a six-figure intelligence analyst with access to the same data as the president of the United States, and he could watch drone strikes in real time. It's a remarkable story.
So you were obviously fascinated with Edward Snowden. Did you get to like him as you were writing this book? I mean, what was your personal take on Edward Snowden?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You know, there's people you like and there's people that you think could be like your soulmate. Okay, Edward Snowden would not be my soulmate. Anyone who votes for Ron Paul would not be my soulmate. But I liked him. I just thought like he was an interesting dude. He seemed thoughtful and methodical and kind, I think, and responsible. You know, really trying to do the right thing. Perhaps, you know, I could nitpick his actions here and there, but overall, most of the things that he did are things I would have done.
You had gotten into that position, which you wouldn't have.
Yes. And also, that's right, I could never have gotten into that position because they would have never recruited a lefty like me into the NSA or the CIA. So I wouldn't have been in that position. But I mean, more about like the way he decided to go public and the way he's handled himself afterwards, and I can nitpick, and if you want, I can. But I think more to the point is 99.9%. I think this is a guy who knew what he was doing, and he did a really good job for a young guy without that much life experience, didn't travel that much, had kind of a messed up family life. He's obviously a brilliant man.
So you grew up in the days when libertarians were folks like Russell Means and Frank Zappa. I mean, people who seriously believed in freedom for everybody, you know, freedom to smoke pot or legalize prostitution, things like that. I mean, how did it get taken over by the people who want to ban Planned Parenthood and have gated communities, that sort of thing?
Well, I think that question would probably be better posed of someone who's an expert on libertarianism, which I am not. But I do have a lot of libertarian friends, and I respect them and where they're coming from. But I think it's important to understand that there are several strains of libertarianism. And certainly the major split is between left and right libertarianism. So someone like the young Ed Snowden was a right libertarian. And someone who, like, for example, Rand Paul, I think if he wasn't from Kentucky, would be more of a left libertarian. But he has to kowtow a little bit. I mean, maybe I'm wrong about that. But, you know, Rand Paul, for example, is the only major political figure who defended Ed Snowden in public. Certainly figures that you would have hoped better from, like Hillary Clinton and President Obama, have been very harsh against him and have lied about him on several occasions. So, you know, I don't think it's fair to say that libertarianism has been taken over by people like Carly Fiorina, who lies about the Planned Parenthood video. I think it's fair to say that the Republican Party, and I'm not sure you could really say they were taken over. I think they always had those people in their party, and they're just becoming more and more dominant. And the sort of liberal Republicans, like the Rockefeller Republicans of the 70s, are no more. They're dead. And so you're looking at a GOP that's been taken over that way. I think libertarianism has become, within the Republican Party, a completely marginalized force. Republican Party is a statist party. It's, you know, I think it has a strongly authoritarian bent. Honestly, you know, it might be slightly to the right of like the National Front in France or something, or, you know, Marine Le Pen.
I just sometimes think the corporatists see all ideologies as brands, and they're out to take over and ruin the libertarian brand the same way they ruined the Christian brand. You know, the Christian Democrats and the Christian Coalition wouldn't have sounded quite as nice if they were the corporate coalition or the corporate Democrats.
Well, yeah, under capitalism, money corrupts absolutely. And so, you know, when people say, for example, oh, let's get the money out of politics, well, then, you know, the way you do that is you get capitalism out of the economy, okay? Because as long as there is an inequality of wealth or income in any society, then there will be inherently an aggregation of wealth and power in fewer and fewer hands over time, as Marx and others have pointed out over the years. And I mean, you know, no one's ever disproven that. That always happens. It's inevitable. And you see it here. So it's kind of like, oh, Citizens United, you know, if we could just reverse that decision. It's like, no, I mean, Citizens United is not a bad Supreme Court decision. It's not a bug in the system. It's a core feature. The system is self-perpetuating and self-protecting. And so trying to smooth out the rough edges is like being the nice SS guard at Auschwitz who doesn't kick you into the gas chamber, but pushes you in gently but firmly. People just have to understand the nature of the system. And I think that's just sort of just the way it is.
One of the people that you talked to, you sat down and talked to for the Snowden book, is Thomas Drake. And he was a high-level NSA executive, a techie, very tech-savvy.
Yeah.
And he tried to work through the system. He had access to all the same stuff that Ed Snowden had. You know, it's funny, according to your conversation with him, the thing that really offended him was the waste of money, all of the money that was going to friendly contractors who were making a very expensive system rather than a cheaper, more efficient system that wouldn't have gathered mass records. It would have targeted small numbers of records and been a lot more efficient.
Yeah, that's totally true. I mean, I don't think it's fair to say that Drake did not care about privacy violations. He did, and that was part of his complaint. And I think it grew to offend him over time more and more. But yeah, there was definitely, for him, he was a whistleblower in large part because he opposed a program that was costing billions of dollars to do something that another program within NSA could have done for millions of dollars, so literally a thousand times less. And he felt that it was a tremendous waste of taxpayer money. He also thought that the cheaper program was better, that it was more focused and directed at law enforcement and protecting the American people in a way that the programs that were more expensive were not. But those more expensive programs were defended by people in the Senate who were in charge of Senate oversight and within the big muckety-mucks in the military infrastructure, because they all had cozy deals with the contractors that were involved and were all going to go work. So it was all corrupt. So he was really an anti-corruption whistleblower as well as a privacy whistleblower. And he worked his way. He did everything that you're supposed to do. He went to his bosses, his bosses' bosses, his bosses' bosses' bosses. He went to the Senate Intelligence Committee. He talked to his congressman. He tried everything. They all blew him off and ignored him. And finally, he went to the Baltimore Sun and told them what was what, but not very much. I mean, compared to the Snowden dumps, I mean, you know, we're talking about like a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of 1% as much information. Anyway, it was enough to piss off the FBI and the federal government, and they raided his house and set out to destroy his life and his marriage and his relationship with his children. And in large part succeeded, and he's now working at an Apple store in Maryland, outside of D.C.
They tried him, but the case fell apart.
Yeah, they tried him on espionage charges, which is like, excuse me, but don't you have to actually be giving away classified information to agents of a foreign power to be guilty of espionage? That's a leak. A leak and espionage are not the same thing, but the U.S. government has repeatedly tried to conflate those two things. For example, in the cases of Chelsea Manning and Daniel Ellsberg and Julian Assange. So it's they're not the same, but they like to make things confusing. And yeah, it's gross. But Tom Drake is an important character in this whole story, even though he's unknown to most Americans, because Snowden looked at what happened to other whistleblowers before he decided to go on the lam. And he realized quickly that, first of all, federal whistleblower protection laws do not cover him, and that to the extent that they cover anyone, they're really not enforced and they're a joke. And so, you know, it's like having anyone investigate themselves. I mean, it's kind of like, oh, I promise that I will not prosecute you if you screw me over. No, I'm going to try to prosecute you. That's the nature of power. And he knew that as soon as he did this, he would become an enemy of the state and that they would treat him accordingly. And so, I mean, obviously no one wants to be cooling their heels in a prison cell as Chelsea Manning is for the next 35 years. But I think aside from that, there was also a broader point for Snowden, which is he wanted the story to stay alive. And one of the ways that the story could stay alive is with him being free to give interviews. You know, Mumia Abu-Jamal can give interviews and talk publicly, even though he's behind bars. But Chelsea Manning cannot. So that's what would have happened to him.
Well, and in these days of Skype and satellite TV, Ed Snowden can address huge audiences, do Q&As. There's a couple of big tech conferences coming up that he's going to be speaking to. This is kind of his bread and butter these days.
Oh yeah, no, he pulls in five-figure speaking gigs for going on Skype in his living room in Moscow and speaking to South by Southwest, where I saw him, or wherever. Yeah, it's kind of like, aside for the whole my government wants to kill me with a drone thing, it's a pretty sweet gig.
And you do draw the distinction between leaking and selling state secrets, like Robert Hansen did, like Aldrich Ames did. They got millions of dollars apiece. And it seems like even the press has conflated these two things, not just the government.
Yeah, and it seems to me like in the case of the press, I mean, most mistakes that the press makes are born of ignorance and stupidity. But in this particular case, I think they know. I mean, I think it's anyone who conflates Edward Snowden with Aldrich Ames is a lying sack of dung, and they know it. They know they're just not the same thing. I mean, they were not driven by ideology. It was not a political act. It was just I really would like to add an addition to my house act, or I'd like to drive a Viper. So it's like what Snowden did, even if you think it was wrong, it's a political act. You could say it's a bad political act, but it's a political act. They're just not the same thing.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and I'm joined in the studio today by Ted Rall, the author of the graphic biography, Snowden. One of the names you bring up in the book is Daniel Ellsberg. And for those of our listeners who weren't around in 1971, can you give a quick rundown of the Pentagon Papers?
Sure. It's kind of a curious story because most people don't really understand it. So Daniel Ellsberg worked for the RAND Corporation, which is a right-wing think tank based in Washington and deeply tied in with the federal government. And in 1971, he leaked to the New York Times what became known as the Pentagon Papers. Now, the way that manifested in practical terms is that he and his wife came into the office over a weekend and got to work on the copy machines and took as many files that Rand had concerning the early days of the Vietnam War, and Xeroxed them. And you know, these are in the days before Xerox. I've seen the Pentagon Papers on a shelf in the library at Columbia University, and it's about 5 or 6 feet long worth of documents, right? And there were no feeders back then, so it's not like they could just go. They're literally like one at a time, like you know, one. They were just, that's what they did. They must have had a lot of coffee. And then they released all this stuff. Now, the thing that nobody really knows about the Pentagon Papers is that these relate to a period that's much earlier than what was going on in 1971. In 1971, we're in the middle of Richard Nixon's first term in office. The secret bombings of Cambodia and Laos are going on, I believe. And then the Paris peace talks negotiated by Kissinger are the following year in 1972. It's almost the end of America's experience in Vietnam. And certainly the political tie had turned completely against the war at this point. Most Americans were opposed to it. The Pentagon Papers covers the period from the early 60s to the mid 60s. And it's really just kind of like how we got in, how and why we started supporting the Republic of South Vietnam. And so it's almost, even at the time it was released, a historical artifact. An analogy today would be to get papers concerning the U.S. invasion of Iraq from 2002 to 2008. You know, it's like that story's already kind of played out. And I always kind of thought, like, almost like, why did Ellsberg even bother, considering that the political atmosphere had already turned against the war? And I don't even really know the answer. I think it was, he was trying to get us to a point where, you know, hey, let's go back and look and see how this started so that we understand not to do this again in the future. It was much more about that, I think, than about ending the Vietnam War. Or maybe it was like, look, let's like end it once and for all. It wasn't completely finished. I don't know. But Ellsberg did that, and the U.S. government prosecuted him for espionage, and he was found not guilty.
And they also harassed him a lot along the way.
They
famously.
Sure did. But, you know, it's funny, too. Like, the media was different. They were more oppositional at the time. So even though a lot of them were in bed with the Nixon administration, a lot of them were sympathetic to Ellsberg. Ellsberg was also a charismatic and charming fellow, and he looked great on camera, and so he was popular. So they really decided they were going to smear him. And the highlight was when they had the White House plumbers, as they called them at the time, break into his shrink's office and reveal that he had been treated for depression in the 60s, which nowadays, I mean, I don't know anyone who hasn't been to see a shrink, but at the time it was considered, you know, like, oh, if you went to see a shrink, you must be crazy. And he had electroshock therapy at the time, which everyone was like, oh my God, he's totally cray cray. But the word cray cray didn't exist back then, fortunately. That was one of the better things about the 60s. So Ellsberg is an important figure. I mean, you know, whistleblowing goes back to the earliest time. You know, as long as there's been classified information, there have been people who've wanted to reveal it. But Ellsberg is, in the modern era in the United States, is like the whistleblower.
Well, even though he was harassed and the Nixon administration tried to prosecute Ellsberg, it seemed like a lot of really positive fallout came out of the Pentagon Papers situation. I mean, the New York Times really didn't hesitate long to publish the story. There were hearings afterwards. There was a lot of oversight. And, you know, you compare that now with the harassment that Glenn Greenwald has received for breaking the Edward Snowden story in The Guardian and the calls for his head, even among some people in the newspaper industry. And then, of course, Snowden is in Moscow. He's not coming back anytime soon, unlike Ellsberg. So it just seems like a different situation. Certainly, there have been minuscule reforms put in place in the wake of the Snowden revelations, but it just doesn't seem to be on the level of what happened back in the early 70s.
No doubt, in many ways. I feel like the United States has advanced in terms of identity politics. I mean, there's less discrimination against minorities and women and you know, obviously trans people, and that's great. But in terms of the police state and economics, income inequality, and the economic class structure of power, that has gotten worse since the 70s. And the media has become more complicit, more slavish, and more useless, frankly. And there's a when you think about some of the things that, like, even in our popular culture, that, like, could be said on, say, the Flip Wilson show, compared to today, you know, like, where someone like, you know, John Oliver is considered to be outrageously funny. You know, it's shocking how much we've retrograded. And, yeah, I mean, it's like, I think if Edward Snowden had done the same thing, if he'd been able to, in 1972, he wouldn't be the one facing prosecution. It's all the leaders in the federal government who were aware of it who would be facing prosecution. I mean, make no mistake, President Obama should be in prison for supervising this program. Every member of Congress who has supervisory authority over it, like Dianne Feinstein, should be in prison. In my opinion, every top official of the NSA should be in prison. These are criminals. They have violated the Fourth Amendment on a massive scale, with impunity, and they should be punished. And, you know, instead, you have Edward Snowden, who's the messenger, and this is about him? No, it's not about him. Not in any kind of fair world where people are thinking straight.
Well, towards the end of the book, Snowden, you take out your crystal ball a little bit and look into the future. And one of the things that you mention here is you talk to a source at the who currently works at the NSA who says sooner rather than later, the web is going to go dark. This is the intelligence community's worst nightmare. And you asked, because everyone will be using solid encryption? And he says, yes, we won't be able to see anything. By the way, I'll pimp KABU membership a little bit, that people who join KABU can get a thumb drive with lots of encryption software on it use while surfing the web and using email.
Excellent. Yeah, no, that's something everyone should do. I mean, they're
So what do you see as being, keep using your crystal ball here, what do you see as being the ultimate upshot of all the stuff that's gone down in the Snowden case?
I think that we're going to end up with, in the same way that we have become increasingly a society of haves and have-nots economically, we're also going to become a society of haves and have-nots in other respects. Like, for example, there are information elites. Newspapers will only be for people who can afford to pay like $8 a copy and who get news that way. And the web, the cheap BuzzFeed news, will be free.
And aggregators.
Yeah, exactly. And I think in that same way, there are going to be privacy haves and have-nots. People who can afford privacy in the same way that they can live in a gated community in the real world will be able to, in the virtual world, to protect themselves by installing PGP encryption and other better encryption protocols on their systems. And then, you know, I mean, look, these things you could argue are all available to the masses, sort of. For example, you can buy an iPhone 6 and it's encrypted point to point, which is great. Or you can get an app called Signal, which is free, and you can, but you have to have a smartphone to use it, right? So if you're poor, you have a flip phone or you use a pay phone, so you can't encrypt your calls and you can't protect yourself. So poor people don't have either the access to the, you know, the spiffy new iPhone 6, or they don't have the access to the latest encryption software, which is always what you need, the latest, or they don't have the knowledge to protect themselves, that they know that there's a problem, that they know that this is an issue, or they're just working 70 hours a week and maybe they don't have time to look into all this crap and try to protect themselves. So there's privacy haves and have-nots. Already there are. I'm a have. I have Signal. I'm going to buy an iPhone 6. But, you know, I can afford a $1,200 telephone, as insane as that is, barely. But most people cannot, and most people are not going to go to this trouble. So I think the way it's going to work is that poor people will not go dark to NSA, and rich people will.
You know, Ted, one of the things I noticed about the book here is that you're really expanding your art chops here. I mean, your artwork is known as iconic. You know,
it's branded. You know it when you see it.
It's characters are more symbols than folks, but here you're really going for a more expressive look with the artwork, with how you're portraying Edward Snowden.
Yeah, that's right. I felt like it was important. You know, if you're going to read a book that's 240 pages of artwork by the same person, I mean, I don't care. You go into the graphic novel section of any bookstore and flip through it. No one's art's that good. You know what I mean? Like, certain, you know, my art is like
Mobius?
Mobius is okay. He's great, but no one's work. No, but still, do I want to see 240 pages of Mobius? Maybe I just have a short attention span. Or, I mean, to me, Joe Sacco is like the ultimate graphic novelist for
friend of the show
for this kind of stuff that I do. I wish I can't believe I've never met him. But Joe is like, he's got the most amazing artwork. But again, I flip through it and I'm like, you know, after 80 pages, I want something, someone else. I read too many anthologies. So I felt like when I was doing this, that was kind of a challenge. And I knew that like having a highly simplistic drawing style, which I usually do, was going to make things, you know, even worse in that way. So I tried to break it up with a more expressive style, more caricature based than I usually do. And then also even incorporating photos and charts and so on, just to, you know, give the eye some visual interest. After all, it is a comic book, so it should have some visual interest. I don't know. I mean, as cartoonists go, I'm more of a writer than an artist. And there are those who are more artists than writers. But you mentioned that that I'm an iconic artist, but then I was looking at my review of Snowden in Willamette Week, and it's like the guy totally doesn't like the book. So anyway, I'm totally going to buy a drone, you know, just for him. You know, I'll live. It's really funny because it's like everyone else likes the book, just not Willamette Week. But all right, whatever.
Well, you know, I mean,
he's entitled to his opinion for now.
I didn't know you're so thin-skinned. You know, every time you come on the show, you make enemies of half our listeners.
Really?
Although, you know, yeah. Well,
what did I do? I'm just drawing stuff.
But you know, you hope that half the listeners will buy your book, and maybe that'll happen.
Well, I mean, I'm not trying to piss anyone off. I mean, it's like, I mean, I believe what I want. I don't try to tell people what to believe. I just, yeah, I do actually. What am I talking about?
Well, anyway. I mean, you are a very abrasive guy. Let's admit it. And you were doing a lot of work for the LA Times for a while. And in fact, they financed one of your trips, at least to Afghanistan, which you talked about during a previous appearance here on the show. And you recently got unceremoniously booted from the LA Times. And there's an interesting story behind that. And there's an interesting story that sort of plays out from there, too.
Yeah, it's almost tied in with the Snowden book in that it kind of answers that question. You know, if you're not doing anything wrong, then why are you worried about state surveillance? And this story kind of answers that question because I wasn't doing anything wrong, but I was state surveilled and I got screwed as a result of it. So what happened was I've been drawing cartoons about state of California and city of Los Angeles, local issues for the LA Times since 2009. But the LA Times and I go back a lot further than that to 1992. And they've been running my syndicated work all these years. They've been very good, dedicated client. So what happened was, over the years, I've done a lot of cartoons that criticize the Los Angeles Police Department, which, you know, frankly, is like shooting fish in a barrel for an editorial cartoonist, because they are the most militarized police force in the nation. You know, I mean, when you think about Ferguson would have never have happened if LAPD hadn't developed SWAT in the 1970s. And they are known for corruption, most recently under the Ramparts scandal, where essentially the LAPD was operating like a criminal gang, and the Federal Department of Justice had to come in and directly supervise the LAPD. So we're just talking about a notorious, corrupt, extremely violent, very racist police force that views the people of Los Angeles as the citizens of occupied territory who are just to be oppressed. You know, the cars all say to protect and to serve, but really it's to protect and serve themselves. And I've done probably about close to 24 cartoons between 2009 and this year criticizing LAPD for various reasons. And they didn't like it, right? And they were waiting for some reason to get me, I guess, as I found out. So in May of this year, they announced a jaywalking campaign for the city of Los Angeles, which is awesome because it shows that the city of Los Angeles has abolished all other crime. And I think that's something that we should all applaud, that they have eliminated serious crime and they can just focus on the one thing that's left, jaywalking. And so anyway, I remembered when I read about this, an incident that happened to me in 2001, in October of 2001, just 3 weeks after 9/11. I was walking in L.A. and I got...
Nobody walks in L.A.
Nobody
according to the...
To Missing Persons.
The Missing Persons song.
That's right.
And a fun fact, you were leaving Bill Maher's show when you got the alleged jaywalking.
That's right. I was literally had just finished taping the October 4th, 2001 show, which you can see online.
Of Real Time with Bill Maher. Or not Real Time.
No, that's politically incorrect. And so I was not actually jaywalking, which for me is unusual.
You're a New Yorker.
I'm a New Yorker.
Jaywalking is just a thing.
It's just a thing. Yeah, it's no big deal. So this cop approached me, grabbed me, threw me up against a wall and handcuffed me and issued a ticket. He attracted quite a scene. There were angry people yelling at him. And then finally at the end, he said, here's your license back. And instead of handing it to me, threw it into the gutter. And so, you know, I filed a complaint in the Internal Affairs Department against the officer, whose name is Will Durr. And basically, they blew it off. They blow off most of their IA complaints. 98 to 99%, according to some studies, are never really taken seriously. And that's what happened to mine. And so, skip forward to May of this year. I wrote about this incident in the blog online that accompanied the online edition of the cartoon, which also appeared in print. So 2 months later, I get a call from a reporter named Paul Pringle at the LA Times, who informs me that the LAPD is disputing my account and specifically the treatment of the cop, that the cop was rude, that he threw my license down, that he handcuffed me. In fact, he said he's never handcuffed anyone on the job in 20 years.
Yeah.
Not even, and I was like, really? Not even his wife? And and it's like, that's just weird. I was like, what a slacker, like worst cop ever. I mean, you know, part of being a cop is you get to play with the handcuffs. Anyway, so he said, yeah, none of that happened. There was no angry crowd. You know, your license was never thrown down. You know, none of it happened that way. The cop was nice, you know, so he was professional and you lied about him. So he said that the proof that the LA Times had was a tape that had been received by the Times from the LAPD that had been made secretly of my arrest by the officer, a microcassette recorder. And so he played the tape for me. And when I listened to it, it was just noise. I mean, you could hear about 20 seconds of talk and then 6 minutes of...
Maybe somebody was pulling espresso. I don't know.
Yeah, kind of. Like, it sounded... That did sound like that. And so I listened to it several times. And, you know, Pringle asks me, like, well, why can't we hear your driver's license hit the ground? I'm like, you can't hear anything. I mean, I was like, I don't think you could hear an atomic bomb if it was on this tape. I mean, the tape's so bad, you can't hear anything. By the way, the original tape is still MIA. This is like a purported dub of a tape. And there's stuff missing from it. So clearly there's been some hanky-panky going on over at LAPD with this recording. But that's a separate issue. So the bottom line is, this went on and on, but he said, well, you know, this doesn't prove your story. And I'm like thinking, well, first of all, I don't have to prove my story. Like, you have to prove that my story is false. And this does not prove that my story is false. And not to mention, is it really so incredible to believe that an LAPD police officer could A, falsely arrest me, B, handcuff me, or C, lie about it? I mean, is that really so hard to believe? And apparently it was hard for this reporter who'd worked with the cops for years to believe. And so to make a long story short, they fired me. They made the decision in under 24 hours. There was no investigation. They never did any basic journalistic due diligence. They never took the tape to a professional audio enhancement company to have it analyzed and enhanced, which is just journalism 101. They never did anything. They just gave me the bum's rush and then published this libelous statement in the LA Times, basically portraying me as a fabulist and as a liar. And so, aside from the fact that it was devastating and it made me furious and sad and worried, it was also false. Okay. So I wrote about it at length online at a website that I'm on staff with, anewdomain.net, and you can find like embeds of the tapes and stuff there. And again, skipping forward 2 days, I got someone to enhance the tape, which means that they cleaned up some of the noise. And one of the things you hear is a woman screaming, "Take off his handcuffs." And the thing about that is it proves that, A, there was an angry crowd of people, or at least there was at least one angry person. The cops said there weren't any. And also that I was handcuffed, something that apparently this officer has never done in 20 years except to me. So I sent the new information to the LA Times, but they ignored it. No answer. I repeatedly sent it to them. Still no answer. They wouldn't even address it, much less open an investigation or look into it. And then other media outlets started investigating, including New York Observer. They got the same results. And Greg Palast, the investigative reporter, also got the same results. So everybody is verifying that there is this lady who says take off his handcuffs. But the LA Times is like, la, 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 I can't hear you, because they've all lawyered up at this point. And also, as I later learned, almost certainly this order came from the highest levels, from the publisher himself, who's a multi-billionaire named Austin Buettner. And when I figured that out, all sorts of things started to fall into place.
This is a follow the money kind of story.
It is a follow the money story. So as it turns out, and again, there's more detail to it than we can get into here, but essentially, the LAPD owns the LA Times. And the way that works, this came into being because of Austin Buettner, who was the publisher who fired me. The LAPD controls a pension fund that's worth about $16 billion. And that is all now, thanks to Buettner, managed by a company called Oak Tree Capital, based in Beverly Hills near LA. That little company, that little private equity firm, also is the number one shareholder of Tribune Publishing, which is the parent company of the Los Angeles Times. So what a tangled web we weave, right? And so it goes even further. I mean, the same police union, it's called the LAPPL, also bought $30 million worth of stock in the parent company at the time of the San Diego Union Tribune back in 2009. And at the time, they were very public about using that money in order to try to get people like me who criticize the police fired from editorial pages of the San Diego Union Trib.
That's bold.
You can even find the live link on the LA Times website still of them announcing that. They've never walked that back ever. So this is a police union that's buying newspaper stock with the express purpose of trying to stifle criticism of police violence against minorities and so on in order to, just keep on killing black people like they're going out of season. And, it's disgusting. It should be illegal, but it's been tolerated. It's not illegal, unbelievably. And, because of this, what you have is the police have completely corrupted the media in the city of Los Angeles. The main story should be reported here in the LA Times. That would be the natural source of news. I mean, they're the main source of news throughout the Southland for all the local radio stations, NPR, and so on. But if they don't cover their story of their own corruption, then it doesn't appear.
Yeah, there's no more LA Herald, for example.
Right, there's no competition. And then LA Weekly is also a bunch of badge lickers. So much for the alternative press. You've also got, local radio is very hesitant to touch this because they don't want to screw around with the LA Times. And even the ACLU, who I used to think was on the side of the angels, I was told by members of the ACLU they would not take the case or even talk to me because they rely on the LA Times to publish their reports. And they're worried that the LA Times would no longer have anything to do with them if they were to help me sue the LA Times. So the ACLU, great amenders, defenders of the, maybe amenders is a better word, of the First Amendment, they're wimps. They will not stand up to corporate or state power in this instance. And it's very disturbing. I mean, the LA Times is the third or fourth largest newspaper in the United States, and it is the largest, most important paper west of the Mississippi River, hands down. So it's been completely corrupted by this disgusting former publisher, Austin Buettner. Former publisher, because he was fired 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, so the fallout continues.
The fallout continues. I'm pursuing my legal options, and we'll see what happens next.
Well, the book is Snowden. The author is Ted Rall. So, Ted, tell our listeners how they can find out more about your work.
Well, just go to my website, Ted Rall Online, which is at rall.com, or you could just Google Ted Rall if you forget. And there's also, obviously, all the usual Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and so on. But I would much prefer that you buy my books from independent bookstores.
Thanks for joining us once again.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Konser. Thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and at KBOO.fm. You can find an archived version of the show later today at KBOO.fm/Words and Pictures. And follow us on Twitter at Words and Picture. Now stay tuned for an afternoon of music on your homegrown Portland radio station.